Hey, welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball, all basketball, all the time. What I thought I would do with this week's podcast is continue our discussion with some of the most colorful coaches in the sport. And, you know, I jostle between the idea of a pro coach or a pro player. I got one coming up next week, and a college player. So what I thought I would do was reach out to a guy who was a pro for over a decade, was one of the most decorated high school players in Southern California history. He began his career at Duke, played for a national championship, transferred to Utah, and now is an assistant coach newly named at BYU. His name's Chris Burgess, and he'll be joining me a little bit later on in the pod. I want to promote a couple things. One, please download, subscribe, rate. If you haven't done any of those three things, I don't know how you got to this podcast, but that, I'm told, helps us out. Whatever. You guys seem to like and eat up these pods. We got some really good ones upcoming. I got a bunch of people reaching out because everybody in Hoop seems to be listening to them. So thank you so much. Download, subscribe, rate, tell a friend, forward it on to them, put it in their queue. Try and listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show, which is daily, 3 to 6 Eastern Time, 12 to 3 Pacific. It's available on Fox Sports Radio, any of our affiliates as well. And it's a growing show. We've been doing it for a long time. It does not just deal with basketball, although sometimes this time of year it feels like it might. So that's a an important kind of distinction, if you will. And I don't know if I'm supposed to tell you this, but you can also listen to it on Sirius Channel 217, XM Channel 203. So plus all of our Fox Sports Radio affiliates, plus our iHeartRadio app. You can listen to us just about everywhere. But anyway, thanks so much for putting me in your queue. Chris Burgess upcoming. Let me give you a couple thoughts on a couple of different series in the NBA. I want to start with Kyrie Irving, who, you ever do this as a parent where the whole time you're growing up, you're like, man, when I get to be a dad, I'm going to do things differently. And I do things differently than my father. I'm much more positive about my son. I'm much more of a hugger, much more of a lover. I try and focus on process as opposed to result. But I will tell you that in coaching my son, and frankly, in dealing with my daughters, oftentimes my default is fall back to what your dad taught you, and I sound like my dad. My dad used to drink Cokes with lemons in them, right? Then he moved to Diet Coke. I essentially do the same thing, only with Arnold Palmer's, right? Like, it's one drink over and over and over and over and over again. So I'm just a creature of habit. He used to get up and read his paper every day. I get up and use Twitter to get to my newsfeed, which takes me to kind of my digital paper every day. Like, and then the words you use, and, you know, like, sometimes you're coaching, and he was a guy that would jump kids, and I'd be like, man, I sound and feel like my dad. And whether it's his real father who's a basketball player, and I think some of that's this, or whether it's his basketball father who's LeBron James or his big brother, feels like Kyrie Irving's become his dad, his mentor. The things that Kyrie says are just the same sort of arrogance, aloofness, where everyone thinks he's bright, everyone thinks he knows the sport, no one's questioning his talent, but man, he says some things that make you really, really uncomfortable. Doesn't that sound like LeBron James? The difference is LeBron James wins more. He's a more dynamic player. He's just bigger, stronger, and frankly better. And when you win and you have the image of LeBron James, you're able to get away with saying some of these things and doing some of the things that he's done. I'd offer up that Kyrie has become like his big brother or like his dad, sort of, in his aloofness and the way he handles himself, not knowing his real dad, just knowing his basketball dad, who's LeBron James. And then the Boston Celtics are a classic case of what happens when you take talent over character or pieces that don't fit together. The Celtics are absolutely more talented this year with Kyrie than they were last year. So too is the rest of the league, especially the Eastern Conference, that should be noted. Like, the Bucks are actually good. They've been good all year. They had the best defense in the league all year. It shouldn't be surprising that they took the Celtics out of everything they want to do. That's what they do. But the chemical makeup wasn't the right fit for Brad Stevens, wasn't the right fit for each other. And they never got out of their team what they should have gotten out of their team. And I'm sure the team will be better because of it, and Kyrie and whoever else departs will go on to great careers and will say, well, maybe it's Brad. No, it's just sometimes a bunch of ingredients together don't make a great meal. Let's move on to the Lakers, where look, this is what happens when you have an inexperienced owner, an inexperienced GM, no assistant GM. You have the LeBron faction and the desire to separate yourself on some level from being Team LeBron. And then you have the pull from others saying, like, let's just give LeBron what he wants and see if he can figure it out. And sometimes you just overthink it, which feels a little bit like this deal. If Tyronn Lue says, I want 5 years and you offered three, all right, so you started low. That's negotiation. But at the end of the day, you got like, all right, let's just get this head coaching thing done and get it off our plate. But instead, you pissed him off. And once you disrespect somebody, whether it's putting Jason Kidd in the staff or dictating terms of length of contract, they understand this is not somebody I want to work for. I want the only way in which you succeed in sports is when everybody's pulling the same direction, right? Jimbo Fisher said that when he got to Texas A&M. Obviously, it was a shot at Florida State, but it's true. The only way you get somewhere and somewhere great is when everybody's pulling the same direction. And the Lakers have the LeBron faction, the Kobe faction. I don't know what Magic wants other than to be a cheerleader. You got Jeannie, her brothers. I mean, it's a mess. It's a mess. And when stories like this get out, combined with the story of the Anthony Davis trade getting out, combined with the Magic Johnson pulling the trigger on his own presidency and making that public, and then LeBron has his TV show talking about it and about just being bewildered and upset and not getting it and no one telling him, you're a coach, you're like, that has no chance of succeeding. Because the only way you succeed is if everybody's pulling the same direction. All right, let's get to the Warriors and the Rockets. Here's my thing on the Rockets. I understand analytics, and I think they obviously do. On the other hand, they kind of help make the argument for us that analytics aren't the only answer when they signed Carmelo Anthony, and of course they had already made the trade for Chris Paul, because Chris Paul's more of a mid-range guy. Pick and roll guy, although he can drive and kick, but he's not really a 3-point shooter. It's not really who he is. They made this case for the mid range and for post ups, and it's interesting. Of the things that have happened that have allowed the Warriors to, they won two games, and look, they could have won game three, they could have won game four, and they got badly outplayed. They did win game five even without Kevin Durant. I think the Warriors are the far superior team. Not when I say far superior, I don't mean like one team shouldn't be in the playoffs, but they're the better team. I don't know if they'll win the series, and if they don't, it's more of an indictment on Houston than it is on Golden State, because Golden State doesn't have DeMarcus Cousins. They don't have Kevin Durant. They just don't. And for two games, you might be able to win. All you got to do is win one of them. It's really all you got to do is win one of them. Over a seven-game series, I don't think they would be able to win the series without Kevin Durant. And, of course, you don't have Cousins. You might get him back next series. You might not. I don't know. So I think it's – but I think it's also an indictment on their style. Like, you need to throw it in the post a little bit and let everybody else space out, maybe cut. But just the idea of constantly attacking with ISOs, constantly attacking with ball screens, like, it's just – you need to vary things a little bit. They don't run creative sets. They don't run creative kind of ball movement, pistol stuff into a ball screen, trying to create downhill action. They just set a ball screen, get the mismatch they want, and go. That's kind of all they do if James Harden has the basketball. And though the stats and analytics would tell you post-ups are bad, okay? The fact is that when Golden State needs a bucket, they do one of three things. And one of those things they do is throw it into Kevin Durant in the post, and of course they run some cutting action off him, some splits off of him, and they allow him also to isolate and go one-on-one. Why? Because it lets everybody else take a break. And so sometimes a tough two or a post-up two is not a bad thing. Also can get you fouled. You can find a mismatch and shoot over somebody, which becomes a higher percentage shot than analytics would tell you. But isn't it fascinating that maybe the thing people are missing on is this, layups, threes, free throws thing in an NBA playoff series, even when the other teams without two starters might not work. And I know you're going to, if Golden State pulls it off, you'll say, well, doesn't that indict how great Kevin Durant is? Because if anybody else lost their best player, I give you the Boston Celtics last year. They didn't have their two best players. They went to the Eastern Conference Finals. Why? Because you can win games on emotion and energy and guys playing above their level. You can. You don't win big that way, but you can win that way. All right, let's get to our guest. His name is Chris Burgess. He's a longtime friend of mine. Played against each other in high school. Heck, I played at his practices when he was in sixth or seventh grade and I was in eighth grade. And he's the assistant coach of BYU. He was a first-team All-American coming out of high school, Woodbridge High School. He went to Duke as a McDonald's All-American. First, in the immediate, you guys were at Utah Valley. And for people who don't know, Utah Valley is like, what, 4 miles from Provo?
It's I think it's like 4.5. In fact, on the I-15, it's the exact same exit. You just drive further up the, towards the mountain for BYU. So, yeah, about 4.5 miles away.
I mean, so do you, I mean, usually when you change jobs, you have to relocate. Do you keep your kids in the same school? Do you move them into Provo schools? Like, how does that work?
I'm actually going to stay in the same home, keep the kids. I've got a freshman in high school, so I don't want to move her at all. I like where she's at. And so we've been in this area near Provo, just outside Provo for 4 years, having been at Utah Valley. So when you can move jobs, right, in Division I and coaching, in the coaching world, and not have to move and keep some stability, I was all for it. And so, yeah, we are staying in the same school, same home, everything.
Is it weird at all? And weird by two different parts. Is it weird because, one, you guys left one school and you're going to, I mean, I think obviously the BYU thing is huge. But also for you, you were a candidate to be the head coach. Like, is it weird at all to be around Utah Valley?
No, I've got, so Eric Daniels is still who I worked with the last 4 years, Donnie Daniels' son, by the way. So Eric Daniels is still on staff there, and Mark Madsen I've known for a while. So, you know, and those players, most of those players are the guys that I help recruit. And so it's not weird. I drive by it on my way to work here at BYU every day, and I've closed that chapter of my life, but I have a lot of good memories and, like, good feelings towards that place, even though I didn't get the head coaching job and interviewed for everything, because I do think it's in good hands with Mad Dog, and I'm cheering for guys like Eric Daniels because that dude, I went to war with that guy for 4 straight years.
What's the phone call like though when you don't get the job?
You know, you're disappointed at first because you feel like you put in all the work to try to become a head coach mentally and physically. You helped build a program that was ranked 322 4 years ago, according to KenPom. And I think right now the season ended as 101. And so we actually looked at it statistically. It's the second biggest jump in a 4 year span behind Nevada, what Musk did in Nevada. And so you feel like you're really part of that. And I think that, you know, the feeling is like, hey, when a coach gets promoted to a better job, right? A better paying job, higher major job, all these different things, you feel like they, maybe an in-house move is the right decision, whether it was myself or the other assistant I worked with, Cody Feger. And when you don't get it, there's disappointment. But at the same time, you know, I had already been reaching out to Pope throughout this process, and I knew there was a great chance that I would still kind of land on my feet at BYU, which is still, like, after 4 years being in Division I college coaching, like, I'm moving up, which is the ultimate goal. So I'll hopefully get another shot at some point in a Division I head coaching job. There's disappointment, but at the same time, like, I'm always like that next play mentality. And so it's like, all right, let's go crush it at BYU.
Okay, so I want to get into BYU because there's a lot of the BYU stuff that I'm intrigued by. But I want to, but before we get there, I now want to kind of go back. All right, so you grew up in Irvine. Right. Did you grow up in the Woodbridge district? Is that where you grew up? Because, like, I didn't meet you until you're playing with Shea Cotton's team the year I stayed back.
Yeah. So when I first moved to Irvine back in, I think, 1986, first came back to Southern California. Anyway, it was Woodbridge. So I grew up in the Woodbridge district.
Okay. So where'd you first start playing hoop?
High school or
no, before that?
In general. So locally, I started just like the Irvine City, and then Pat Barrett and David Stancastleton, David's dad at the time, had started that kind of PTI AAU team, Performance Training Institute team, that we were practicing there in Anaheim, you know, the Anaheim Convention Center, Hotel, whatever is right there. And so we were practicing there, and that's where that sixth grade team started, the fifth, sixth grade team started to form of Shea Cotton, David Caston, Jason Hart. I was always playing up. Brad Williams, right? And so that's where I started. And then PTI eventually grew into SCA, Southern California All-Stars. And you know, with there's only so many, you know, Southern California AAU teams, Branch West being one, SCA being one, of course, ARC with the Twins, K-Swiss with Paul Pierce and Baron Davis. And so, and then Slammin' Jam, right? Those were kind of the main teams. And I kind of, I stuck it out with Coach Pat Barrett. And up until my last, honestly, like I played once July circuit with SCA, and Pat was flying in all these different dudes from all over the country that I bounced like my last couple tournaments and went with a Utah-based team.
That's fascinating. It's interesting. So the names for people who you're tracking all these names. Okay. So, yeah. David, where the hell did David Castleton end up playing? He played Southern Utah.
So he went to, he played up at Fullerton. He ended up at Fullerton after he went junior college. I think he went to OCC, yeah. Orange Coast College for a year or two. And then he ended up playing at Fullerton.
And then, Brad Williams, the other name you brought up, he played football at Notre Dame. He actually grew up, his house was literally right behind mine.
Yeah, I know.
We're like two guys that played, went to Notre Dame, and I don't know if he, I have no idea what happened to Brad. His parents don't live in that house anymore. But here's how far back I go with Brad Williams. We first moved to California in 81. My dad was an assistant at Long Beach State, and his mom used to babysit me after school. And this is all I remember about it was they had a pool, which I thought was the greatest thing ever because we didn't have a pool.
Of course.
His mom raised dachshunds, like she bred dachshunds, which were among the most annoying dogs on earth. And they had a conversion van. They were like the first, the only people I knew that had a conversion van that had a TV in it. And we used to play on, I think we used to play on the same football team and some same basketball teams, whatever. And he was a year younger than me, but he was a behemoth. And I used to love going to games with his parents because we'd watch TV in the van, like up until game time, and we'd come scurrying out of the van.
Yeah. His dad was just as big as Brad, right? I remember his dad, if I remember right, his dad was big, strong, but just this like teddy bear of a guy, like just funny. So it was Big Brad. We always called him Big Brad. And then we had Brad Smith on the team. I don't know if you remember him, but he played at Long Beach State, and that was little Brad. So, yeah.
It's an amazing team. And then Jason Hart. And so what happened was when you guys were in, I'm going to say sixth grade, you guys were like the best team in the country. And I was in eighth. I think I was eighth grade and I stayed back. Or maybe you guys were in seventh grade. And anyway, I had no team to play with. So I played with a team in L.A. And I played in a league at Westchester High School. We played in leagues in Compton College. And then I practiced with you guys a couple days a week. And I mean, you guys were, it was an unbelievable, like if you go back and look, like there's unbelievable players kind of in that gym. Why do you think, I know Shea has a documentary out there. I mean, like I want to get into your career, but why do you think Shea never made it?
Well, he was the same size I saw it from. Eighth, seventh, eighth, ninth, all the way to a senior, it was kind of the same size, right? Like, he was just bigger, stronger, and more developed than every one of us. I mean, he was a good almost 2 years because he had stayed back. He was like a good year and a half, 2 years older than me and some other guys. And so he was just so developed. And I think he just had so many distractions, right? Where James Cotton, his brother, went to Long Beach State, less distractions. And he ended up making, I think, a roster with the Sonics for a little bit. I just think there were so many people pulling at Shea, wanting him to go here, wanting a piece of him there, wanting a piece of there. And at one point, he retires from high school basketball, right? Does that sound right? I can't really. I want to say he starts at Bosco, right? Transfers to Modern Day. Senior year, transfers back to Bosco and decides to retire, right? So there was just so many distractions.
To get ready for college. Like, it was the most bizarre thing. And for people who don't know, we're talking about Shea Cotton was on the cover of Sports Illustrated. This is the year before Kevin Garnett declared out of high school to go to the pros that he could be, you know, the next, you know, the first, he could be the next Moses Malone, right? That was Shea Cotton. That's was right. That big left-handed 6'5", I guess he was a 2-3, which is interesting, which is kind of like you. He was kind of born too soon a little bit. Did he need to shoot it better? Like, yeah, he never shot the ball nearly well enough. But it's interesting, like, the way in which you play center, you played center as like a stretch five, like and rim protector defensively. Like, now you'd be golden. Whereas back then it was like, why is Burgess out here shooting threes when he needs to, you know, score with his back to the basket? Am I wrong?
No, it's 100%. It's 100% true.
Okay. And Shea's the same way. Like, now Shea was, they wanted to make him into a guard, and like, dude, he's not a guard. He's like a 3-4. And now he could actually play four. Again, he would have to have improved his shooting. But it is interesting on how basketball, it's like you guys were born a little bit too soon.
Yeah. Yep. And he has some weird things, like the retiring from high school, then, you know, committing to UCLA and it not working out, and then eventually ending up at Long Beach City and then Alabama. Had a solid year at Alabama, right, with Grizzard and Mo Williams. I think he averaged 13, and he's all-newcomer team at the SEC, and just leaves, right, even though everyone's like, not getting drafted, but just leaves. I mean, this dude went against Ron Mercer's team, Oak Hill, in high school, and he's the best player on the floor, right? He goes against Marbury's team, Lincoln, out of New York when he's at Modern Day, and Shea's the best player on the floor. I mean, this dude is – he was so good. I witnessed it for like my whole childhood and high school career.
Really, really amazing. Okay, let's talk about you. So you go to Modern Day your first year, and I remember that team because the worst game I had in my high school career was against that team at Ocean View. I had a triple double and I think it was like 11 turnovers, something crazy. And that team, tell me if I'm wrong here. So Miles Simon was, I'm going to say, a senior, right? You had Darren Height, who I grew up playing with. You had Mike Carrick, who I grew up playing with. You had you. You had Mike Vukovic, who played at UC Santa Barbara. You had this freshman group of you, Kevin Augustine.
And me, Vukovic. And then Clay McKnight was a junior.
Okay, played at Pacific. He's one of the great shooters in the history of college basketball.
And then Sean, right, whose brothers had played before.
Sean Jackson, who played at Wyoming,
Sean Jackson. Yep, Sean Jackson. And then Josh Porter, who I think went to Cal Poly.
Yeah, and his son's one of the best teenage baseball players in America,
that's right,
by the way. Yeah. So, I mean team, like, that was an – you might have had David Drakeford, too. Was Drakeford the same year?
No, he wasn't there with me. He wasn't there with me.
Yeah, Drakeford must have been the year before he went to Oregon State. So this is all one team at Modern Day. And you had this great group of freshmen. Why'd you leave?
Yes. Wasn't comfortable. I loved Coach Manai. I loved the staff. As a freshman on Modern Day, just wasn't ready, wasn't comfortable. I grew up in the public school system in Irvine, missed my friends, you know, started not really liking the game. I was a baseball player as well, and they kind of just stuck me on the baseball team, this like frosh off team that wasn't really good. And, you know, I'm a 14-15-year-old kid at the time, and, like, baseball was a big deal in my life. And, like, my buddies back at Woodbridge were all playing. And I honestly just, even though I lived at home, I got homesick of just being kind of Modern Day and just not knowing a ton of guys, right? And so that's why I transferred. I went to my dad, and I was like, I just want to go back and play with the guys I grew up with, the guys I grew up playing baseball with, the guys I grew up playing City League with. Like, I still think we have a chance to be really, really good at Woodbridge, and this is what I want to do. And it was tough. Like, my dad was kind of bummed. Like, he really loved the whole Modern Day. He loved McKnight. He loved the fact that I'm getting my butt kicked every day in practice, right? And it was going to be another year with Sean Jackson coming back. But ultimately, I just wasn't having as much fun. And it might have been because I was a 14-year-old kid just getting my butt kicked every single freaking day by Division I players.
Listen. The reason I didn't go to Modern Day. Now, I didn't go to a – I didn't – I grew up – you know, you could walk to El Medina High School, where my brother and sister went.
Yeah.
And honestly, you probably could walk or ride your bike to Foothill High School. Instead, I went to Tustin High School because Tom McCluskey was the coach, and they won the state championship. I just felt like it was really good. I didn't dig the whole Modern Day thing. And then what I came to really embrace is I didn't mind not having the best players. Like, I know that's for some people. And it's interesting, kind of the Modern Day thing has been copied 50 times over now. But I didn't mind, like, in hindsight, like, we didn't win. We lost in the CIF finals to Dominguez my senior year. And I remember my junior year, those guys, we played Dominguez at Compton College, and I mean, we had guys that just pissed down their leg, right? They were so scared.
Yeah, of course.
And it was, but I actually kind of enjoyed the process. It was a lot like what it was like to play at Oklahoma State, where like right. I'd prefer to do it that way as opposed to the kind of put together all-star team way, where you just, you have better players than everybody else 95% of the time. I think it builds. And I agree with you in the baseball thing. I will tell you, like, my thing, I was a baseball player. I wasn't as good as you were at baseball, but I love baseball. Tustin was really, really good. And
really
my thing was,
yes,
like, my freshman year, we went to the state tournament in basketball. And by the time I came out of it, like, everybody had positions and I got stuck. Same thing, like, frosh soft team. And I was a catcher, and they're like, well, we already have catchers. You got to play second base and third base. And, like, there's rockets coming down my way. I'm like, So you go to Woodbridge, okay?
Yeah.
And you have this unbelievable high school career.
Yeah.
And you got a decision to make. Now, here's where it comes back to the BYU-Utah thing.
Right.
What was it about BYU out of high school? I mean, there's a ton of pressure from the Mormon church, right, to go to BYU.
Yeah.
What was BYU like when you came out of high school?
So I grew up in kind of a BYU family. Like, of course, my dad went there, right? So and it's just like every Mormon kid, right, that's all over the world. Like, you know about BYU, and you know about the school and what it represents. And so I've always kind of like went to a ton of football games and watched them on TV if they ever were on TV. Anytime I was in Utah during growing up, I'd come to a game at the Marriott Center. So I knew all about BYU. And I didn't, like, there was no social media, or I wasn't in the state of Utah where I felt a ton of pressure about going there. I genuinely liked the state of Utah and having some family there. I liked the fact that there was like 20,000 fans. You got to play in this big arena, right? The Marriott Center. I loved the coaching staff, and because they had been recruiting me the longest and the hardest since my freshman year. Because you have a 6'9" freshman, 14-year-old kid out of Southern California. Of course, they're going to do their homework and recruit you. And so, I had a great relationship with staff, and it was Coach Archbold was an assistant, Tony Ingle was assistant, and of course, Coach Roger Reed was the head coach. So, they had cultivated such good relationships with me on all ends that, like, I thoroughly enjoyed those. Being around those coaches. And then there was a good recruiting class for the class of 97 with Britton Johnson, right? McDonald's All-American out of Salt Lake. McKelly Wesley, an All-State kid who ended up being Mountain West Player of the Year his senior year at BYU. Michael Johnson, a Seattle-based kid who ended up signing at UW. So there was like a good class. And so I was intrigued, like, hey, like we have something going here. Now, BYU was really struggling the time my senior year. I think they actually finished the year 1-26, right, or 1-27, and so to me, it was not really. It was more about what I could accomplish at Duke in terms of winning national championship, Final Fours, playing in the ACC, right, going against North Carolina and Dean Smith and these things, and so that kind of was it was about that for me. And then they had signed a really good class. And that was kind of the last piece of the puzzle with Shane Battier and William Avery and Elton Brand. And I thought, man, this is, you know, we grew up in the era of the Fab Five too, right? So I'm like, oh man, this is a Fab Four type thing. And we're going to go to the Final Fours, national championship, just like C. Webb and those guys did. And this time we're going to win it, right? You have all these dreams and aspirations of what you think can happen with your career. And I think it was more about that than anything, right? It was more about that than anything.
It's kind of interesting, right? It's like history repeats itself a little bit, where you went to modern day to play kind of with a dream team. You weren't comfortable. You go to Duke to play kind of with the dream team. We played you guys your freshman year in the tournament.
Yeah, we did. That's right.
It was a great game. Game's tied with 2.5 to go. And Coach Sutton never called. He didn't call plays. And all of a sudden he starts yelling out and he's doing some symbol, like making his hands like spread out. And I'm like, I don't know what you're saying. And it was really loud in Lexington. So I called timeout. And we ran it. And he was like, I'm just telling you to spread out. Just telling you to spread out. And I was like, well, shit, you didn't have to make some hand signal. I thought I was missing a play call, you know? Anyway, we ran a play called Cowboy Fade. And Adrian Peterson, it's that kind of 2-1-2 set hit me in the middle. And then we have, you know, flares on each side. And I go to Adrian Peterson, and he's open for a catch and shoot, but instead he drove in and missed a drive. And Rashad McCloud was just it was just such a hard matchup for us at the time. He scored like two straight buckets. We missed a couple, and then we fouled. We ended up losing by six. But that team, for people who don't remember, okay, so Wojo was a senior. Ricky Price was in the doghouse as a senior. I grew up playing against Slick Rick. Nate James, Taman Domzowski, like, got zero burn. Like, Taman Domzowski and you on the same team, like, that's a lot of big white guys. But it was it was the three Bs, zero right? Burn. You, Battier, and Brand were the freshmen with William Avery, Chris Carrowell, Trajan Langdon, and then Rashawn McLeod, who was his first transfer, right, out of Rutgers. What was your Duke experience like?
It was good. It really was. Like, I enjoyed my time there. And some of my closest friends to this day are not only, like, guys I played with from my first year there, but, like, some of the classmates I had. Like, I enjoyed it. I learned so much from Coach in terms of, like, you were not, like, he was all about, like, the name on the front of your jersey, right? And it didn't matter who he recruited, whether it was Elton, whether it was, like, Okafor, whether it's Marvin Bagley. No one's bigger than Coach K, right? And no one's bigger than Duke or his program. And that's what he was so good about. It was all about, like, culture, the program, and motivation and playing hard, right? And there was no overcomplicating anything. Like, obviously, I played for Majerus in Utah, and I know we'll get there, but it was like, hey, we're going to play hard on these guys. We're going to play it this way. It doesn't matter what they run. We're going to show on ball screens, and we're going to front the post, or you know what I mean? We're going to get up the line and make it difficult to pass, and we're going to spend 10% of our on scouting and 90% on us. Right, and you can do that because you got 8 McDonald's All-Americans and 3-4 future lottery picks on the team. But I like that. I like that. I got to play like in a Maui Classic. I got to play in Elite Eight and a national championship game. And I got all these experiences that you dream of as a kid, right? You dream of as a kid. And so my experience was really good. It was just like you said. I'm not an ACC back to the basket five man. I was never comfortable that way, and I'm a 6'11", probably like 230-pound, you know, center in the ACC trying to go against Brendan Haywood, who's 7'1" and 270 pounds, and Elton Brand every day in practice, who's, you know, so it's just, I'm not an ACC center. I'm not a back to the basket center. That's how I felt.
Well, he also wasn't willing. We weren't at the point in time when he was really willing to evolve and to have a face up five, right?
Right. Right.
I mean, that's really kind of what it comes down to is it's like a different era. You mentioned the national championship game. Your last game at Duke was in Tampa against UConn. Rip Hamilton and Khalid El-Amin, sorry. And you lost that game. That was a we shocked the world upset.
Yeah.
What do you remember about the game?
They locked up Elton. I remember that. Elton was the player of the year that year, and they had Bosco and Edmund Saunders banging him from behind, like, you know, pushing him on him from behind, and they had Kevin Freeman, who's now an assistant at Penn State, you know, front him, and they absolutely locked up Elton. We couldn't get Elton going. Trajan had a great game, I do remember that. And then Ricky Moore was kind of the X factor for UConn point guard. He wasn't a scorer, he's more a facilitator. But he scores the first, like, 12, you know, he has 12 points the first half, and he's kicking Will Avery, who was his high school teammate's butt. And then we had zero answer for Rip Hamilton, zero answer. And he was, I mean, this is before analytics, right? Where it was mid range after curl after curl after curl after curl. And I remember it being a really good game, back and forth. And Khalid hits two free throws with, 9 seconds left to go up three. We come down. We give the ball, of course, to our senior, Trajan Langdon, or our junior, who's probably, you know, he's really, I mean, no, he was a senior. Yeah, senior Trajan Langdon. He comes down, and we don't get a shot off. They double him and cause a turnover. And when it ends, right, it's because it's so hard. I don't understand. It's so hard to get to a Final Four, let alone a national championship game. It's so hard, and the season is so long. And when that buzzer goes off, regardless of the celebration and the fans, regardless of anything, it just comes, like, flooding down on you of, like, we were so close. Like, we may never get back here. Like, it's over. Like, I remember that, like, overwhelming feeling of, like, are you kidding? Like, this was really hard just to get to this point, and nothing showed of it. So anytime I watch a national championship game to this day, I feel for I felt for Texas Tech. I'm looking at Matt Mooney and being like, it's the worst. And I didn't play. Obviously, I mean, what was I, 12 minutes a game, 14 minutes a game. I'm looking at Matt Mooney and Owens, these guys, and I'm like, Culver, I'm like, this is the worst feeling in the world, because you're going to remember that for the rest of your life, that feeling and that so close but didn't get it. Like, it's almost like I'd rather lose in the Elite Eight.
I'm going to disagree with you. I lost in the Elite Eight my last game. I'm going to disagree with you. But yes, nobody remembers your team. You go from, Seinfeld always says it about the Olympics, right? Like gold medal, bronze medal, silver medal. I mean, silver medal, bronze medal, never heard of them, right? So
I tell you,
Elite Eight, we had a great team my senior year. I mean, like a great team. And we were a little bit ahead of the curve. We played mostly four out, one in. But we ran into Florida, who was just crazy talented. We had some guys that were a little bit under the weather, but like they jumped on us and our game plan wasn't great. Here's how it was, I remember for us is, you know, we only had like a day to prepare as you do for the national championship game. And what sucked was John Pelfrey was their assistant.
Yeah.
And Pell had actually come to our practice mid-year. He was like at our practice for, I think, 2 days taking notes because we were one of the best defensive teams in the country. And he had played for Coach Sutton. He's best friends with Sean Sutton. And even though he's an assistant in Florida, we're like, we're never going to play Florida. Like, yeah, come on, watch practice, whatever. And he wanted to see like how he got us to get after it, right? And Coach Sutton was much the same way as Coach Krzyzewski. We did do a lot more scouting report stuff, but it was more like, hey, look, we're post-doubling every time. We worked on seal and rotate, but it was more get up in the lane, get on their ass, make them turn their ass to the glass, make them play like they're tentative and run through passes and go play basketball. But I remember like he knew everything we did because he was at our practice. So we get ready for the game and coach is so freaked out about their press that the day before we work on our press breaker and I'd never been like, there's never been a press that's ever affected me, you know, as you know, playing with my dad, like that's all he worked on in AAU basketball, I used to love it. And we're spending all this time on press breaker. And I'm like, why are we working on press? Like, that ain't just give me the fucking ball and get out of the way. Like, let's go. And we took off our secondary break out of the press breaker. And this is like before analytics, if you would have statted, like we scored almost everything out of secondary break, not out of our half court offense. And our zone offense was crummy. Right. We just had really good shooters and a really good passer. And so we end up like breaking the press and they gave us a little bit of problem. He got a technical foul. We tried to run a trick play to throw a long once or twice. And but whatever. Once we started like just getting our press break, breaking it, they called off their press. And they did so. They go back into the zone, but he never put us into our secondary break, even against the zone. And so we couldn't. But regardless, we end up we tied it, and then Mike Miller hits a three, and I think Dupe hits a three, and we end up getting not necessarily run out of the gym, but it felt that way. And I remember that's exactly what you're talking about. Like the buzzer sounds, and at the time you're a sophomore, so you still had life. Like for me, it's over. And I remember buzzer sounds, and we were mad because one of their guys dunked the ball. Like it was like 11 points and they dribble out the clock. One of their guys goes in and tomahawks the ball as the buzzer's going off. And we all wanted to fight him. And we're shaking hands. Like you're shaking hands with Billy Donovan. And you're just standing there and you're watching them celebrate and get ready to cut down the nets. And I'd kind of watch that for a little bit. And you start going to the locker room. You look around, you're like, I can't believe it's over. Then it's over. There's no more practice. There's no more games. There's no more anything, right? You're sitting around in the locker room. Do you remember what Kay said after the game?
I don't. I just remember he came around and hugged every senior's first and then hugged every one of us. That's all I remember. I think it's the feeling, right? When our season ends, and I know like last year, you know, we lose in the WAC tournament or whatever at Utah Valley, and it's more of like, coach is like, you know, meet in the locker room. I'm not sure exactly what to say to these guys. I don't know what to give these guys. And it's just like, I think it's more just the feeling, right? Like these guys are just going to feel. They're not going to remember anything we say, but they'll remember the feeling. And I do sadness.
So, what do you remember about the decision to transfer? Were you watching the game, going like, "I'm out of here," or was it you got home
not
and then
at
you?
All. I got home, and you know they had a really good class coming in, like they always do. It's a Duke, and Elton was leaving, and I'm like, "Oh yeah, nice." Elton's leaving, and me and Shane and Dunleavy and Jay Will and, you know, Boozer and these guys and a great team. And I just thought it was more of just like, you know what, if I'm going to be this five man, like, you know, back to the basket five man, screener, roller, rebounder, which I took pride in. I'm like, I want to go play for a coach in a system where I'm gonna get developed, but it's one thing to develop in practice and on your own, but it's another thing to get developed with game reps, right? I think that's how bigs get developed. I mean, everybody, but mainly bigs, because that's what I am. So I'm like, I'm gonna go to a play for a coach that that ball goes inside some more. Like, that was our saying, and so that's what it was. When I transferred, yeah, I talked to UCLA and some other schools that were close to home. I think I actually even talked to you, your brother. No, your brother wasn't there yet, San Diego State. But I know I talked to San Diego State and UCLA, and actually even talked to Irvine, where I'm from. And I was like, I'm going to play for Rick Majerus. I'm going to go to Utah. He's killing it in the WAC, which was turning into the Mount West. And this dude is going to – I mean, first of all, I had known him. He recruited me out of high school, and I went to their big man guard camp as a kid, and I knew how good he was with the post. But the thing was, he threw that ball inside. And so now I get to play in the Mount West, get the ball, get a ton of touches in the post. And it's a good team that's going to compete for a Mountain West championship and, you know, an NCAA tournament good seeding. And so that, to me, that was what it was about. I'm going to play for coach.
Why didn't you transfer to BYU?
At the time they were kind of on the down right now. They're working their way up, new coach. And, it was more about Rick Majerus than the actual university. It was more about Rick Majerus and what he'd done with post players. And of course, he's good with guards. I mean, look at Andre Miller's, has one of the best storied careers in both in college and in the NBA. But it was about Rick Majerus and post development more than it was school, right? That's why it's like UCLA, I was a huge fan of this home for me. San Diego State, come on, you're in the beach, good level. But I was like, you know what, I'm gonna play for this coach. He's killing it right now. And I was close with Britton Johnson too. We were good friends. I was like, we're gonna crush this thing together.
By the way, I think my brother was at San Diego State at the time.
Did he come over there with Coach Fisher?
He was there with Fish, but he didn't join Fish until like the fall, I think.
Yeah.
I'll give you a quick story about how bad they were. Like, you remember, like, this is amazing about San Diego State. Like, they were so bad when we grew up.
People don't know that. They won zero games my redshirt year in Mountain West. Zero.
Yes, they were terrible. So we play him the next year is Fish's first year, right? Or maybe that was the first year. And I had thought about leaving there because we're going to play for Majerus during my junior year, because I was in the doghouse and I wasn't enjoying myself. And so coach schedules a game with San Diego State, because I think he wanted to go to San Diego the next year because he thought we were gonna be bad, and he's like, at least I'll be in San Diego. Yeah. So we play him in Oklahoma City, and we're up like 40-14 at the half, and he comes in and we're like sitting there and we're, you know, pounding our chest or whatever, and we got a really good team, and he sits down next to me. He goes, you tell your brother you better go get some players, brother, because you can get your ass fired, they're terrible. Right? Turns out, by the way, the next year San Diego State did beat Oklahoma State at Viejas. I think it was Cox back then. Anyway, yeah, they were bad. So what was sitting out? You're with Majerus, and for people who don't know Majerus, like, I almost went and played for Majerus before I transferred to Oklahoma State. That was really two of my final three schools: Marquette, Notre Dame, and I mean Alabama a little bit too, and then Utah. And the only reason I didn't was it was a week before I was going to visit, and they passed a rule where if you're a Prop 48 and you graduated in 4 years, you got that year back. So you got a fifth year kind of for free, and your first year became like a redshirt year. And his whole thing was like, hey, Andre would have been a sophomore when I got there. And hey, you'll play with him for a year, same backcourt, and then it'll be your team for 2 years. And then, you know, when he got the year back, they're like, well, he's probably going to be here 2 years. And he was honest. He's like, I don't think that's really what you want to do, be a point guard for 1 year. Anyway, I'll never forget. So I went to practice. They played UCI. This is 96, 97. So this is your last year at Duke. And I went to practice. And they had Mahorn. They had Doliak. They had Metala. They had a squad. And they had Andre Miller.
Yeah, they were loaded.
And their practice was unbelievable. Like, it was... He used to, and you tell me if this changed, whatever. He'd get onto somebody's ass, and then two lines, and the guy would run over to the baseline, and no one is looking at him. Like, they were so disciplined that he didn't have to look at anybody at all. And he would go two lines, and they would run down and back would be, I think that would be two lines. You tell me if I'm wrong. And or he'd say like four lines.
Supposed to be down and back twice would be two. Down and back
okay.
twice. So down.
Okay.
Is
so they're
half,
going down but, and back twice, right? But I'm like, yeah. like nowadays, like I, so I have workouts with kids 3 days a week. And if I just tell them to run a lap or whatever. But I hate that I have to watch them like, hey, you're not running hard. Take another lap. Like he'd literally two lines go. And then, you know, yeah. and he down, back, down, back, get back into the drill. And then he would have his walk-ons.
Jump right back in.
Huh?
Jump right back into the drill.
Right back into the drill. And then locked
right
in. And then yeah. he had, and I remember he had his walk-ons that he would take with him on the road. And then they would, you know, when they do scouting report, everybody would sit in their chairs with their notebooks open. And the walk-ons would run through every offensive. They'd run through an offensive set, then they come guard it. Then they go back, they'd run through an offensive yep. set, then they come guard it. What did you do during your redshirt year with him?
So I was one of the scout guys. Like was one of, so I was part of the walk-on. We called it gray squad because we had these gray jerseys, and usually the jerseys had a whatever number we were going against. So the first, like, what is it? The first, we have 3 weeks of preseason before your exhibition game. I'm actually, like, part of, like, the red and white squad, right? I'm thrown in there. I'm going against Hano, who is a preseason All-American every day, and it's awesome. I'm loving it. And then as soon as the games start, then the gray squad, your scout team is introduced. Then I was thrown on scout squad, which was pretty fun because you had to learn all the plays, which is fine. But, like, you had the green light, and, like, coach was more focused in coaching on the actual eligible guys or the guys who were going to get some playing time. And so, I'm telling you, I could do whatever I wanted in terms of within the offense that, you know, we were scouting, things like that. But it was fantastic. Now, he was exactly what you said is exactly who he is. You played with fear in the gym, right? Where this generation, we always talk about joy in the gym and juice in the gym. But there was no joy or juice in the gym for Coach Majerus' team. Like, there was fear. But, like, his guys played harder than anyone, was more prepared than anyone. And like you said, like, he would say, well, he would always be like, two sprints, five sprints. You can go over there, you run your five. And you knew at any time Coach could watch, or he would have the video guy up there in the stand go back and see how hard you ran those five sprints, right? And so you just knew. You didn't mess around. You just didn't. Like, there was just too much fear. And so, boom, you jump back in the drill, and you'd be tired as all get out. But you knew that, like, at any point, like, you're going to get sent on sprints. His practices were long. He taught, stop. But I'm telling you, like, I was able to play 11 years professionally overseas for so many different teams because I was taught the game the right way, right? Yeah. I could fit into any system or any style because I was taught the right way. And that goes a long way overseas because sometimes your Americans come in and they just want to score, and, you know, and not want to guard and know how to guard ball screen, not how to guard the post, and not help size. But with Majerus, he was to the point where you were just so well-disciplined and so well-coached that it didn't matter where I went. I could fit right in. Oh, yeah, I got this. No problem.
Okay, so your first year, you had Britton Johnson, right?
Yeah.
Didn't you have Lance Allred too? Wasn't he a good player?
He was a good player. He was actually my backup for my freshman, my junior and senior year at Utah. But he was a really good player. He was Big Sky Player of the Year after he transferred. But yeah, Lance was on the team. Britton was on the team. Britton Johnson, Travis Spivey, which was a Georgia Tech transfer for.
Yeah, that was the guy who took the spot. Well, I don't know if that would have been mine or whatever. I almost went to Georgia Tech. And they took Spivey instead, I get some funny Georgia Tech stories. And then you had didn't you have Kevin Bradley was like a scoring guard too.
He was one and done, Crenshaw's finest. He was one and done. Yeah, the grades after his first year there as a junior. So funny story about Kevin, love him, great player, but he came into our end of the year meeting. Majerus walks in late at this hotel there, the Marriott, right there on Wakara Way. And he walked in. He's like, Kevin, this is your GPA. And it was really bad. He's like, I told you and your mom on the home visit. I wasn't going to put up with this. Like, you can be excused. You're off the team. Kevin, like, kind of looked around, stood up, walked out. I have not seen Kevin Bradley since. Now, I've talked to him on the phone, but I've not seen Kevin Bradley since that meeting when coach is like, I told you. And he's our leading scorer. Like, he's our best guard. It's unbelievable, right? And that's, again, it's fear. But he's like, I told you, you didn't want to do your grades. I told you and your mom, you're out. Never seen him since.
Okay, so here's the best Majera story that I will share on this that I know. What's the kid who I'm thinking of, he transferred to Oregon, I think.
David Jackson.
David Jackson. Okay. David Jackson didn't play with you, did he?
No, so I came in when he transferred. Like we missed each other exactly.
Okay, so here's the I won't tell you who told me this story, or maybe I'll tell you offline. But he goes and he goes on visits right after leaving Utah. And this particular group is, at like most coaching staffs, like what I hate about my job or some people who are in my job is the way in which we portray college basketball coaches as like most of them are just a bunch of guys like me and you, played basketball, that love basketball, love kids, love the locker room, like, right? And are kind of smart asses, you know? So they're at dinner and they're like, okay, we can't order any food until you give us your best Majera story. And so David Jackson says, just the other day, they're like, just the other day? He's like, yeah, this just happened. He said he went up to Majerus's hotel suite to ask for a transfer. So he knocks on the door and he walks in and Rick answers the door in a towel. And for most people who follow Majera stories, they often involve some form of nudity. Yeah. Oh, David, sorry, just got out of the shower. And sits here. Oh, sorry, coach. Sorry, you don't call him coach, right? You call him Rick?
Some people call him Rick. Some people call him coach. Just whatever you're comfortable with. He was fine.
Okay, his whole thing was like, don't call me coach, call me Rick. That was when he recruited me, at least. And so he said, sit down. So he goes, Rick, we talked about transferring. And he's like looking down, like he's like no self-confidence. Like, you're telling Rick Majerus you want out. So he's kind of hemming and hawing. He looks up, and Majerus is out cold asleep in a chair with a towel, barely dressed. Now he starts to snore, and you're like, what do I do here? Like, what do I do to wake him up? So he sits there for a couple minutes, and finally he's like, oh, the hell with it. He kind of like nudges him. And Majerus goes, oh, David, sorry. This medication I've been taking, it knocks me out. And then he goes, and it makes my ball swell up. And he shows him like his ball. And David Jackson's like, Rick, I want to transfer. Can you sign the release? Thanks for everything. Goodbye. And he like walks out. That's his Majera story. So in it, you can give me a less or more graphic one. Give me your best Majera story.
So I got a good one, and it didn't involve me. I got great ones that involve me, but they're graphic and the names calling things like that. But I got a great one that I tell everyone. I think it's fantastic, and it's how he rolled. So great, one of the great teammates I played with, Mike Pusey. Okay, he's from just outside north of Salt Lake City, Utah. He's 6'9", big guy, and he's on the recruiting. They're on a home visit. Rick Majerus and Jeff Judkins, who was his longtime assistant at the time. And they're at his home visit. And at the home visit, you got Mike Pusey, of course, a 17, 18-year-old kid. And you got his pops. And then you got mom and sister, okay? And so coach is giving the whole spiel. Coach is, so honest to the point where he's trying to, he's trying to scare me away, but he's being so honest. He's like, listen, I got Keith Van Horn. He's going to be senior next year. He's going to come in here, have to guard him every day. He's going to destroy you, all these different things. And he's like, for you to be able to compete and eventually earn time, you're going to have to gain weight. And he's like, and I'm looking at your mom and your sister, and they're both really heavy, so I know that you got it in you.
Who is this?
This is Mike Pusey. So Mike ends up signing there. He plays 1 year during Van Horn's senior year, goes on his Mormon mission to Sweden, comes back, and Mike's a sophomore return missionary during my redshirt year. I play my redshirt year with Mike, we're juniors together, and then coach ends up taking a scholarship away, and Mike transfers to Utah State. And now Mike is an AD out here in Roy High School in Salt Lake, outside Salt Lake City. But like I'm telling you, man, like that's the kind of control and how honest he was. But you respected him in this weird way, where a guy like Mike signs there, and it was Judkins, Coach Judkins' job at the time to kind of calm the family down.
Yeah,
But I just saw Mike the other day, and on my 40th, a couple weeks ago, and I brought up that story. He's like, "Oh, he told me all about it." He's like, "Oh yeah, he said this." He's like, "Coach, though." But like, can you imagine? I can't imagine going into a home visit as an assistant, first of all, and hearing Coach Pope say that to a recruit, and then us still getting him. Like, there's just no way. There's just no way.
That's amazing. Now, is it true?
Go ahead. Go ahead. Sorry.
No. You got to what?
I was going to say, you got to get, I'm telling you, Britton Johnson on your pod. You got to get him, man. He does jazz radio now, and he does things. But first of all, he's got an unbelievable career and the things he had to do. He's got some unbelievable stories. He does the best Rick Majerus impersonation you've ever seen or ever heard. It's unbelievable.
Okay, so here's the other story. Now Rick did he also had a cruel side, right? Like Mark Jackson. Who was a point guard, freshman and sophomore with you. And, he would only call him the C word, right? Like
that's it.
Okay, and this is what I was told. Ray Giacoletti gets the job after Rick leaves. And Mark Jackson comes in and says, Coach, I want to play. And he's like, I'd love to have you. And he goes, I just have this one thing to ask you. And he's like, what's that? He's like, will you promise me you will never call me the C word? And he was like, done, easy, sale. Why would I ever call you that? And he's like, that's the only name Rick Majerus would ever call me. And and he was like captain. He like walked away from the team, like quit because of it, right?
Oh, he quit and like, I mean, he ended up coming back, like you said, for Jack, and was first team all Mount West, went to a Sweet 16 with Bogut, and big time, I'm telling you, big time player, tough as nails, Salt Lake City kid, and couldn't take coach.
Yeah, there are guys, and we had that at Oklahoma State, who couldn't handle it. You know, the Graham twins, for example, like both the twins played in the NBA. Stevie never started at Oklahoma State. And really, like, you couldn't play him because he was so worked up over playing for Coach that every time he came in the game, he would travel. Like, first time he got the ball, he would travel. And we try to convince people, like, listen, he's actually a really good player. He just can't play for Coach. Some dudes can't do it. Some dudes can. It's really – okay, so you get done playing.
Yeah.
Right? And you had a good senior year. I wouldn't say you had everything you wanted in a senior year. Is that fair?
That's fair. Good senior year, but good senior year, especially coming off a junior year. That was I felt like my junior year was disappointing. We did win the Mount individually. Collectively, we did win the Mount West, which was great. But senior year, not great senior year, but good senior year.
So it's you. I mean, like, dude, you had good big guys. You, Lance, you know, and Britton, obviously.
Yep.
So you go from McDonald's All-American, Duke, fifth-year guy, like almost 14 and 7, and you didn't get drafted. What's the feeling like to not get drafted?
Oh, so you're just bummed, right? You're disappointed. And there's like a lot of just regret, right? There's always regret about your career. I should have done this. If I could have been this. If I'd have been mentally tougher here. You know what I mean? There's always regret. It's like, it's all of us as players, right? And competitors, even after games, it's like, you don't leave it out I didn't feel like I left it all out there or whatever, but I didn't blame anyone. I do remember that, not blame anyone besides myself, but there was this like, okay, my agent calls and is like, all right, we got three teams that want to bring in, you know, for summer, right? The summer league. And so at that point, when the draft was over, I ironically called Majerus, like, Coach, I've got the Pacers, the Suns, and the Knicks that want to bring me into summer camp. I need help, right? What do you think? Can you talk to these guys? Because he knows Scott Lade with the Knicks, and he knows Coach Iveroni, who's an assistant with the Suns and Pacers. He was really good president, so he'd call him and he did all his research. And the next day he calls me, he's like, I think the Suns is the way to go. And so they had drafted Amari and Casey Jacobson, and basically Jake Boskal and I were going to compete for kind of this last roster spot. And so I went in Suns and played summer league and got to play in Salt Lake and the Mountain Review and got to play in Long Beach. It was great. Got invited to training camp and ultimately was the last guy cut. But yeah, there was definitely disappointment, but there was also this like, all right, let's make this another way. Like, and your agent's telling you, hey, it's better if you don't get drafted second round, you have more teams to choose from, which is completely true. But the competitor in you was just like, no, like, I wanted to get drafted. I wanted to hear my name called, right? And so disappointment, bummed out. But at the same time, I was like, all right, let's go. Let's find this right team and let's make this roster a different way.
So what'd you do?
So I went to Phoenix, summer camp, played actually pretty well. Got to play alongside Amari, which was, I mean, he's obviously was what he was, right? Rookie of the year. And then ended up getting cut the day of the last
game. What was he like? I mean, because, like, listen, Amari's still playing in Israel, and he's a shell of himself, and he hasn't been really the same since the knee. But he was right out of high school, but he was a freak. What was he like to play with?
So competitive. First of all, the first day you played with him, the dude had no idea how to play the game. But what he didn't understand one thing about, you know, spacing or screening or moving. But what he did know is to attack that rim. He did know, like, where the ball was, and he just had this knack of knifing through defenses to score. And then D'Antoni, obviously when he played for D'Antoni the following year, and they're running ball screens with Steve Nash. I mean, come on. You know, that's what he can do. Great dude. Really funny. I mean, he's really funny. He's older for he's a rookie straight out of high school kid, but he was older, right? And so he's really talking in the bus. Really good teammate. Like, just fun to be around. Like, he brought a lot of joy to practice just with his competitiveness. And not, like, you had Gugliotta, who was a vet. Bo Outlaw, who's a vet. And this dude, and Sean Marion's been there a few years, just signed a big deal. But this dude, Amari, was like, no, like, I'm the alpha dog here. I am the alpha dog. So I remember during the preseason games, I turned to Scott Williams. I was like, this dude might get rookie of the year. And then Scott was like, he's going to get rookie of the year. You don't have to worry about that. And he did. He got rookie of the year.
So you went to play for the Idaho Stampede, who I was on the Idaho Stampede right up until the first. My Idaho Stampede story is Brian Gates coached me in the USBL. So I was supposed to play. My agent had a team that was going to play in Russia and live in Italy, but I had to play as an Israeli, and I didn't get my papers because when I went to Israel, I told them the truth that I was living in Italy. They're like, no, you must live in Israel. And anyway, so I come back. There's like 14 point guards at camp. I end up as one of the last two. Aubrey Reese got hurt. It was me and Darren McClinton. And I'll never forget, like, we used to stay at the hotel. And we were going, Rory White was the head coach. And we were going back and forth to practice. Yeah. And we used to pick up the Idaho Statesman and look in the transaction page. And we'd look at guys that got cut in the NBA. We're like, oh, he's going to take somebody's job in the CBA. He's going to take somebody's job. We were kind of messing around. And I remember seeing Randy Livingston's name. And I mean, I was there as a camper when Randy Livingston tore his ACL as a counselor at ABCD. And so I knew how good Randy Livingston was. And so I remember picking up the Idaho Statesman on the way to practice one day, like, oh, Randy Livingston, oh, he's taking somebody's job for sure. He's an NBA dude. He's taking some CBAs. And we were just kind of joking around about it. So we have like picture day. It's like 2 days or 2 days before the season's going to start. Brian Gates had literally called me and said, hey, tell Angie, like, my girlfriend's in Oklahoma, like, we'll share a U-Haul to move our stuff up. Like, I'm good. I'm set. I'm thinking about picking out apartments, what I'm going to do. We're taking pictures, and we're taking, like, half-court shots and trick shots. And I look down in, like, the vomitorium, like, that leads towards the locker room, and I see this tall, bald dude. And I was like, oh, shit, that's Randy Livingston. I'm going to get cut. And so we go that night. We play a scrimmage or an exhibition against College of Southern Idaho. And I was like, I thought I was like fighting for a starting spot. Like, I had beaten out Darren McClinton with the USBL. I was starting ahead of him at the end of the year. But D-Mac had been there the year before, so he was like the vet. So I kind of had to earn it. And I was playing great. It was probably like you, right? Like, you played in college and you felt like you were kind of free of the system. And you felt like you're older than most college kids that come out. You're really comfortable. And the NBA game, the court is so wide open. There's so many possessions that you can kind of pick and choose what you want to do when you want to do it. And I didn't play a minute, and I was like, oh, damn, I got cut. What was your Stampede experience like?
So, funny, you know, Brian Gates was the assistant coach, and Rory White was the head coach. And so, same two guys you just talked about. So, they had drafted me. So, when I got cut, they reached out right away through my agent and me, and was like, hey, come over here, come play. You got the spot. So, I did. Flew out there, went to training camp. I was in, you know, outside Boise, which is great because it's only like a four-hour drive from where my wife's from, my girlfriend at the time when I was getting married. And so it was close. I felt like it was near Utah. Good guys on the team. Played the first few games, and my agent called was just like, hey, there's a team in Turkey that basically wants you to come, but they're not going to be able to pay that buyout. It's just the truth, right? And it's like, but if you – so I went and talked to – after four or five games, I was like, well, you know, I think I can get called up. And played another game, was like, I don't know, we had this call up, and it was a really good deal in Turkey. And so I went to Gates. I went to Brian and was like, can you just release me? Can you just release me so I can, you know, I can go home and, you know, I can get my rights back and this team doesn't have to do a buyout. And so Brian was a stud, man. Like, I owe him to this day. He released me, went home for a week or two. The team was like, it was kind of like the holiday break there in Turkey during the December time. And they brought me in, flew me out, and ended up playing there for the first year. And really, like, it really worked out, because that was really the right place for me to get started in Europe. Because, like you said, I wasn't in this college system anymore. We're back to the basket. Like, I would pick and pop. I would trail three, because the coach was like, you have to take open shots. That's what we do here. Like, what? Like, if no one's guard, like, shoot it. Shoot the ball. Shoot the ball, right? And so it was just the mentality they had.
It takes you a while to break out of that mode. Like, you just get rewired by your college coach. And, you know, I remember playing in Russia, and my coach would say, you know, like, you must shoot. And I was like, damn, I'm just so wired to turn down shots. Then you went to Australia. Then you went to Australia. What was that like?
Loved it. Oh, man, loved it. It was great. It was a good league. The money's so there, but great league. Again, it was one of the things, like, I was a stretch five there. It was awesome. Great teammates, good players. Aaron Baines for the Celtics was actually on our team as, like, the development player, as, like, a 15, 16-year-old kid. So it was fun. Played there 2.5 seasons and put me in a situation to go play over back in Europe for a lot more money. So Australia kind of put me so I went to Turkey, got a nice contract in Australia, and then that league put me on kind of a different map over in Europe. So I went back over there.
But you also did the spring league stuff, right? Didn't you do Philippines?
Yes.
And for people who don't know, like, guys who are European basketball guys, you know this. Like, back then, and I don't know if it's, I think it's still the same way, when you play CBA or now G League or whatever, I don't know if you can do a G League, but back then you play in the CBA or some other stateside league. There was ABA for a while too. Or you play Australia where you don't make a ton of money. One way you can make up for that money that you lost out staying home is to go play in Venezuela, Philippines, Puerto Rico, where they're like 1 or 2 month leagues, but they're more money for a shorter period of time, right?
That's right. And they're looking for at least the countries I played in. So that's what I did. I went to Philippines, I went to Puerto Rico 3 different times for the spring and then part of the summer. Cause it's Australia league ends early, right? It ends in February, where Europe goes all the way to like June and July. June, sometimes July, depending on the league. But I was just like, hey, I'm young. There's only so long I can play. And I felt really good. So you go play in Philippines. Like you said, a lot of money for 2-3 month seasons. Hang out, you did the playoffs. Go play in Puerto Rico. And then you'd add basically all of July, half of August, sometimes all of August, to kind of recover and get ready for the next season. But I would do that, especially as a 5-4 man. Those leagues like Philippines and Puerto Rico, they're always looking for 4s and 5s.
You played in Ukraine as well. Like, dude, you went all over. So for a guy who never went on his Mormon mission, you basically went on a Mormon mission. But you mentioned your girlfriend, now wife, and you guys married with a whole bunch of kids. Like, what was your relationship with her like when you're traveling around chasing the basketball dream?
So she was great. She's a former D1 athlete as well. So she understands time, commitment, and energy that it takes just to survive as an athlete and competitor. So she would come over with me right away at the beginning of my career. And then when kids started to get added to the equation, and then they started going to school, I kind of go over the first month, 6 weeks by myself. She'd come over for, you know, 3/4 of the season, and then she would come home a good 6 to 8 weeks early, right? So she wouldn't stay there the whole time. And that's kind of how it was the last 6 or 7 years of my career. And then the last year, we had our fifth kid, and she was like, I'm done. Like, this is difficult. I'm done. And I was like, well, I basically called her bluff. I was like, I want to play one more year. And I'm like, assuming she would come over. And she's like, you don't understand, I'm done. I'll come out for, you know, the month of December, I'll take the kids out of school. So that my last year, which was in the Middle East, UAE, I was out there by myself, except for that month of December. And that was like the hardest year because she's raising five kids on her own. I'm out there by myself just living this like basketball bachelor life in terms of having zero responsibilities besides staying in shape and performing, right? And so I actually the team wanted to sign two more years on the deal, and I told them I can't do this anymore, and that's how I kind of fell into coaching.
Okay, so there's a bunch of questions I have. How hard was it to keep up with the real world? Like, now you were able to play in the internet generation, you know, like just when I was like when I was in Russia, I remember Rusty LaRue was in Moscow. And he would video chat. I forget what service he would use with his kids back in North Carolina. Yeah. And, you know, it was still dial-up days. And I remember, like, Israel was cool because you could still watch ESPN and you could most of the events. But, like there's 2 years there when I was playing where I have no idea what happened in college hoop. And there's a bunch of NBA stuff I don't know anything about. Yep. Forget about football, like nothing. And it's one of the reasons that I quit playing because I got a chance in the broadcasting industry. And I was like, if I stay too long, I'll have this like void in my memory bank that I don't know what people were talking about. How did you keep up with, forget about, and then I want to get to parenting. How'd you keep up with the real world?
Yeah, so like I said, I didn't watch any college basketball or any NBA, right? Just maybe overseas, they might show a game or here, but I didn't watch, like, everyone talks about Carmelo Anthony and Syracuse. I never saw Carmelo Anthony play in college, right? And everyone's like, that, you got to go back and watch. Like, exactly, right? So my first couple of years was kind of dial-up internet, and then, you know, the whole, what was it? I mean, Wi-Fi wasn't even around. You still had to connect DSL, and then eventually there was Wi-Fi towards the end of my career. And I would try, I got different things like Sling Blocks, and I got different things. Honestly, it was just one of Twitter finally came out, but it wasn't that big of an application to use. And so really I would just kind of talk to my friends and family back home, through texting or instant messaging or emailing. And they honestly would give me kind of recaps. I would go on ESPN.com and I'd try to watch all the highlights from the night before, right? I'd try to, go on YouTube, but there were certain countries, sometimes YouTube you couldn't get on. And so I try to go YouTube and watch different things, but I was really out of it. Like, even my own water, like Utah, I didn't even know some of the players. You know, I go back in summer, I'd be like, hey, who's this guy? Who's this? I have no idea. I couldn't keep up. And so you're just kind of out of it, and you're in your own world. Like, you really are.
How did you
the league you're playing on.
How did you parent?
When they were gone, Skype. I would Skype with them when they'd be out, when they'd be over back here in the States. I would Skype with them probably every day or every couple of days. I would do that. So that was basically my, I mean, I missed the birth of my second born. I was in Puerto Rico and my wife went into preterm because she was going to fly out, but she went into preterm. And so she stayed in Salt Lake and it was an April Fool's baby. And so I actually thought she was joking when she sent a text basically saying I'm going into labor. I didn't even believe her. But then her mom had called me and been like, hey, she's really going to have this. And so that's kind of like, that's just a small little story of like the life that you just live to be able to play this game, which I still loved and had a lot to give. Like this game, I had so much more to give and I wasn't done. But that's just kind of the way it was. I would do Skype. I would call them. I'd send emails. I'd send pictures and do the best I could. Now, when they were there, right, my wife was really good. About taking care of the kids, having the house, bringing them to games. Cause you know, European gyms, right? They're so loud. So the kids had the headphones on. So my kids literally grew up in arenas, and in gyms all over the world when they were with me for those 5, 6, 7 months of the year. They grew up in arenas.
Give me the best food listen, you've traveled literally all over the world.
Yeah.
Give me something that you tried that to this day you still love and tell people about.
So Turkish food is probably my favorite. I love their doners, their kebabs, the thing they got on that little spinner rotisserie thing, but it's right side up. But there's like this kind of pasta and Greek yogurt, and they call it Iskender, I-S-K-E-N-D-E-R. It's called Iskender meat, which I think is probably a form of, I think it's lamb, but it's by far the best meal if you have like a teammate's wife prepare it. It's unbelievable. I would have it 3 times a week out there. In fact, I coached a kid this last year at Utah Valley who's from Istanbul, and I would talk about like, hey, like you got to one of these days, you got to make me some Iskender. If your mom comes in town, like you got to do that. It's my favorite food. He's just like, that is like a Turkish, that is a Turkish like delicacy there. So Iskender, who's my favorite.
You never tried salo in Ukraine, did you?
No, I didn't. I didn't go outside the box too much in Ukraine. Or Mediterranean food's not bad too, but in Ukraine, strictly like kielbasa, steak, things like that. I stuck with that.
Yeah, so salo is it's like uncooked pig fat. It's like bacon, but only I think it's all fat, and it's like super seasoned. And we had a couple Ukrainian guys on my team in Russia, and the Russian guys used to mess with them, you know, like when they'd make shots, they'd be like, oh, blet, you must be eating salo. You must be eating salo, blet, which blet is bitch. And they would throw in blet at the end of every sentence. You eat salo, blet. Oh, what's the matter with you, blet? Shoot the ball, blet, right? Like every sentence. Anyway, so you mentioned it to your Ukraine dudes. All right, what is the, give me the best, like, crazy playing basketball overseas story to somebody who has never lived that lifestyle.
On the court or off? Because off is probably the most interesting, crazy.
Go,
stuff.
Go. Either. So give me one of each.
Off the court. So I'm in Ukraine, right? My wife's 7.5 months pregnant with our third, and we're trying to find a hospital, right, that she feels comfortable with. She flies over there and trying to feel comfortable, and so I end up. She's ended up really, really uncomfortable. It's not working out with the team. So I go to the management. I'm like, hey, listen, just pay my last month. Release me. Let me go over to Turkey. There's a team that wants me over there. It's like for a coaching staff that I already know, about the same amount of money. My wife's comfortable in Turkey. She knows a wife over there that's going to take care of her, and she's comfortable with hospitals, right? Because we'd lived there before. She's in the hospital. So the team released me. They owe me a ton of money for this buyout because they agreed to buy me out too. And
what's a ton of money to be owed?
They basically owe me like $30,000 in cash.
Okay.
And for me to leave, for me to just kind of walk away. And so I know, and I've got to go to this Turkish team. I've got to report in Turkey in 48 hours or it's not going to work, right? I got to report in 48 hours or they're not going to sign me. So I have to get released and collect this money in cash because I know if I go over there, they're not going to pay me. Right, they're just not going to pay me, and so I go over there, and my wife's packing up the house. I get the money last minute. We fly over to Turkey, hold two kids, dog. We find a hospital. Now she's gonna have this baby in Turkey. So my wife's gonna have this baby. We go to Turkey, find the right hospital. She's having this baby. It's Islamic country, so I'm not supposed to be in there. They give me permission to be in there. Okay, the doctor is smoking in the hallway before he's delivering baby. I have to like shield this doctor. I have to shield this doctor off because I don't want my wife to see it. Okay, I don't want to see her smoking. They have the baby. She ends up having the baby there. I don't like they don't have any diapers. They don't have any clothes. They don't have anything. So I got to run back and go get it.
They don't have any diapers for a baby in a hospital?
No. It's like bring your own everything. It's bring your own everything, right? And so she has the baby. I got to go pay for it. I'm not insured, like, you know, maternity and all these different things. I'm not insured. So I go up there and pay it. And I'm like, hey, can I spread this out over a couple credit cards? They're like, sure. And then it ends up being like $230 for everything. Ends up being like $230 for everything. So my wife's able to have that baby. And afterwards, my wife has to get a tetanus shot. Because she's like, hey, not everything might be sterile, so just in case, let's give you this tetanus shot.
That's madness. Amazing. I'll give you a quick Russian hospital story, okay? So I land in Russia, and I've been playing in Salina, Kansas for like 2 weeks in the IBA to kind of get in shape for Russia. So they had offered me a contract, but they wanted me to work out with them. The team's gone. And on a road trip, and they're coming back like in a couple days. So they're working me out by myself. Like literally, they don't have this team. We won the Russian league and won our European league, but they didn't have a junior team really to speak of. So I'm like alone in a gym for an hour and a half in the morning and 2 hours in the evening. And they're just like coming up with drills for me to do. I mean, it was crazy.
Right.
Like they were like, how many threes must you make in a minute? I was like, I don't know. Feed me. Let's see. Like, okay, go. And I was like, wait, there's nobody feeding me. Like, no, we want you. So like for conditioning, I just like how many threes you can make in a minute. And then you take a minute off and then you do it again. And you take a minute off and then you do it again. So I'm like exhausted. I'm eating terribly. I'm not sleeping. Anyway. So they're like, they want me to sign this contract. They don't want me to send it to my agent. They want me to, like, it's in Russian. I'm like, no, I'm not signing anything in fucking Russian. So anyway, they're like, you must go to physical. So I go to some hospital in Perm, Russia. And it was like one of these things where, I mean, it looked like out of the 1960s Russia, right? Everything's gray or like some weird, like, greenish color walls. And you go into one room and they, like, check your knees. And, like, they have you, like, bend down and bend over and they work on your knees. And then you go to another one and they check your back and they x-ray your back. And they go to another one and they check your hearing, you know? And they get another one, they check your eyes. So the last one I go into, is, like, a dentist. So I go in and they, like, have me open up and the lady comes in and she's, like, looking at my teeth and she's got all gold uppers and all gold lowers. And I go, I'm good. My teeth are good. No thanks. No spasiba.
No thank you.
Oh, man. That's funny. I mean, well, there's people have no...
I don't know. Do you remember Paul Shirley, Iowa State? I'm sure...
Of course. Yeah, he's that book, right?
Okay. That book. Like, anyone who goes overseas, like, I'm telling you, they talk about it. I'm like, dude, you got to read Paul Shirley's book. And it's a different era, of course, through the generation. There's probably so much more things. But that book is fantastic because I was probably on my seventh or eighth year over there, and I'm, like, laughing the whole time because we all had these similar stories as players doing with coaches or people in the city and the travel and the agents and all of these things. And they're just, like, it's just a reminder of how crazy it is. And like, you have to really love this game to make a career over in Europe. You have to love it.
You'll get people, Chris, you know this, you'll get people who tell, like, oh, well, you know, if it doesn't work out, I'll just go overseas. Like, do you have any idea? You have any, like, you got to change every part about your life. You're playing for people who have no respect for your upbringing. They don't care, right?
Yeah.
They don't care. And you have no idea. You're one year commodity.
They don't care about your health the next year.
And in all honesty, like, they don't even, the contracts don't mean anything to most of those people. Like, what are you going to do, sue me?
No.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's an amazing thing that you have to do. Okay, what about playing? Because I do think that there's a ton of things we've taken from them. There's some shit they do that's weird. Like, I still don't understand the wrist stretch thing they do or the knee roll around your knee stretch thing that they do.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
Soccer warm up. It's soccer warm. They have the soccer mentality, right? So the way they, like, we would do these tempo runs for the first 10 minutes of practice around the court. And I'm like, come on. Like, we're not soccer players, right? We're basketball players. Like, we don't need to warm up the same way a soccer team does by running around the field. I can't stand that. For 5 minutes, you run a certain way and then counterclockwise the last 5 minutes. So they would do that, like you said, that knee stretch. I just think it's, you know, it's just a different mentality over there. And they love their two-a-days, right? You always come in the morning, either going to shoot or lift, and then come back in the evening, and you're going to practice. And so, like, I always tell people, like, if you're not in the EuroLeague or Euro Cup, or you're just in a domestic league, like, you're paid to practice, like, 10, sometimes 11 times a week, and then you play one game a week. Like, you have to love this game because – and your wife better be supportive if you're married and she's going to go over there, because it's not for spouses. It is just not for, some countries are, but for the most part, it's just not. You got to love this game.
No, it's in fairness, it's a job and they don't care.
It's a job.
And most other jobs don't care either. I think people in the States care a little bit more than they do otherwise. But it's okay. So you decide to go into coaching.
Yeah.
What was and here's the funny thing about Mark Pope, who you work for. He can attest to this story. So I don't know if he still has it. Does he still have the same cell phone number?
No. It's 4 years old now. I do know that.
Okay, so 4 years ago, you go back before that, when he was at BYU, they gave him Dave Rice's cell phone. Like, same number. Okay, so for Dave Rice's first couple of years at UNLV, I don't know if I saved Dave's new one or his old one, but I did a ton of UNLV games. Like, one year I did 13 UNLV games. And I'm telling you, like, ask Pope. I would, like, text him, like, hey, can we grab coffee? And he would text me, like, I don't drink coffee. I'm like, yeah, you do. You're not Mormon. He's like, yes, I am. And he's like, mess with me. I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I know you're not Mormon. Like, yes, I am. And I'm arguing, I'm like, dude, I'm outside your office. Why would, like, this is Mark Pope. What are you talking about? Like, oh, shoot, I didn't know. And he would, and for whatever reason, like, I don't know why. Maybe I just never deleted it or sometime, but his, but Rice's number became his number. And even when he was at Washington, right, he'd still, I think he still kept the same number. I don't remember who was where, but it's actually, so what was the decision like to get into coaching?
So I was overseas my last year. I knew it was going to be my last year. And a buddy of mine, was his name's Phil Cullen. He's now with the Spurs front office. But Phil was my teammate at Utah and was the director of basketball, assistant director of basketball office position at Utah. So I kind of messaged him on email. I was like, hey, I've still got like five classes before I graduate. I actually never got my degree. And so I messaged him like, hey, can I come work some camps? You can throw me some classes. I'm actually going to do this. I'm going to finish. I'm going to get my degree. I'm so close. I'm retiring. I'm done. I'm gonna get a job. But I'd love for some classes. And so he calls. He's like, hey, we can actually pay for it if you'll be kind of an undergrad student coach. It's kind of this weird little loophole where you're not, it's not quite a grad assistant because you're not doing your master's, but we'll pay for it. And we get the bonus APR point. You know, so he's like, it's a win-win for us. I'm like, yeah, sure. What do you need from me, though? If you're going to pay for it and I can work camps, he's like, what do you need from me? He's like, well, coach is just going to have you kind of be a student coach and you'll be on the scout team or, you know, might have you kind of be this liaison between players and staff. And I was, and I've always kind of wanted to get into coaching because I've enjoyed being around it and I love the game. So I thought this was a good way to see if I really wanted to do this. Fell in love with it. Of course, it's DeLon Wright's first year and Utah has had their best year, you know, since, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, since the Boylan era. So I loved it, was around it, and I was like, I want to do this. So I was talking to some guys on staff, like, help me out, what do I need to do? Like, I'll do whatever, I'll volunteer. So I kind of worked my way as a student assistant to Indian Hills Community College, which is a big-time junior college out there in Iowa, and was hired there full-time. And then while on the road and while recruiting, you get to know all these coaches. It's just what you do, right? You network, and Mark Pope gets the job at Utah Valley, and I had a decent relationship with him. And I just cold call him like all of his coaches do as we're networking. I was like, hey, I don't know what you think about your staff. This is what I bring to the table. I'd love to do it. I'm all in. So he interviewed me. He interviewed me at the Final Four and ended up working out. And then I'm there at Utah Valley for 4 years and I've learned so much. You know, learned so much from him and kind of now, you know, was able, lucky enough to still stay on staff with him. But that's kind of, it was kind of one of those things where it's like, I want to do this. How do I do it? And you, and when someone in my position, right, as a former player, sometimes you, there's a stigma of big guys can't coach and former players just expect to have whatever. Where I was like, no, I'll do whatever. If I got to volunteer, if I got to go junior college, I just want to coach. I just want to be around these kids and learn. And so that was kind of my path 6 years ago. And now, you know, I am where I am, which is assistant coach now at BYU.
It's amazing. How Mormon were you when you were traveling?
Say that again.
I don't want to get you in trouble, BYU. Like, how Mormon? Like,
No.
I mean, like, you know, in terms of what you're eating, church on Sundays, yeah. You know, like, yeah. Like how I'm Mormon, how, yeah. Huh?
I'm a very active member of the Mormon church. Like, I go to church on Sundays. I have a temple recommend. I go to the temple. I was just at the temple a couple weeks ago. So I'm a very active member. Don't drink coffee. Don't drink alcohol. Same with that. Like, the honor code for me at BYU is my lifestyle. I don't need to sign the honor code. Other than, like, I got to shave a little bit more now. Got to keep clean shaving where before I might go 4 or 5 days without shaving. But yeah, like I'm.
Wait, so you got to? I didn't know that was part of the honor code. You have to shave every day?
Yeah, I think you got to be. I'm pretty sure you got to be clean shaved. You know, every couple of days you got to shave, make sure it's no scruff and beard. So yeah, that is part of the honor code. And that was the only one maybe I had to kind of change my lifestyle a little bit with that, because, you know, I might go like 4 or 5 or 6 days just not shaving, because I've never been asked to do it, right? I never actually held a job where they really cared about it or you need to be clean cut in terms of your that part. So that's the only change I've made in my lifestyle, is like I shave every day. Other than that, though, it's been such an easy and a fun transition because I live that lifestyle.
How do you convince a non-Mormon kid to come play at BYU where there's no drinking, there's no smoking, you got to be clean shaven, and there's going to be no sex during their time in college?
So I think you have to find the right kids, and you got to find the right kids. And what we do is like, hey, we're not about like there's nothing negative about it. We try to say we want to find the kids that will embrace it. Kids that want to embrace the standards we set, right? The reputation that we want these kids to have. We want these kids to be all in on just being a student athlete. And like, listen, there's things that do at BYU, and you're going to have great relationships with not just this, your fellow teammates and other athletes from football and things like that, but you're going to find other students you're going to go along with. There's some fun things to do here in college. There's like 30,000 student body. But my thing is I'm more of like, I sell BYU like the history, right? The Marriott Center sitting 19,000. The Dove CC going against Gonzaga and St. Mary's, our preseason schedule, playing in Maui. You know, this summer we're taking the European tour. And our style of play, what I sell Coach Pope, what he's done in terms of transfers or in terms of high school kids and how he's developed them. Our staff, all these kids want to be pros. Well, we've got two guys on our staff that played, have a combined 20 years professional experience at all levels, you know, and we have so it's more of I try to sell those things. And BYU, the atmosphere, the history, Jimmer, Danny Ainge, Brandon Davies, who's one of the best centers. He was just named first team all EuroLeague overseas today. Like, I sell that, and I try to get these guys to understand if they're all in on playing ball and working on their game and being around other guys who are about that as well, then they're going to fit in just nicely, right? And if these kids don't, and they don't want to buy in, and they don't want to follow the standard, then those aren't the kids that we should be recruiting to BYU, right? And we find that out pretty quick.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's going to be amazing. Any chance Yoeli comes back?
I don't know. He's such a talent. He's so talented. I mean, obviously, he's done so much for BYU the last few years. I don't know. Coach Pope has been working really hard to try to educate him as best he can about the whole process, especially for Coach, right? Coach was a late second-round pick in the NBA draft, and somehow fought and clawed his way into contract after contract year by year, right? So what better coach to talk to, right, in terms of how he made it in the NBA? And so I don't know. I think I think, you know, all these kids, not just Yoeli, even if they're projected late second or not, their whole thing is, like we talked about, I'm going to go play professionally overseas or somewhere. I'm going to play somewhere, whether it's a two-way, whether it's the G League, whether it's overseas. It's hard, man. It's really hard.
It's really, really, really hard. Everybody see like it. It's like it's the overseas thing, the G League thing, everything. Like, okay. Or you could come back, you average 21 this year, you could average 25 and have a Jimmer like season. Last thing, and this is important. You mentioned the big guy thing. Like, there have been some great big guys as coaches. Phil Jackson, of course, is a big guy. Coaches are former point guards, right? It's like managers are usually catchers, and point guards are seen as seeing the game. Give me something about Pope that he does, and you've played for. I mean, I'd love to have another pod and try and have you name every coach you've ever played for. That would be an amazing test of your memory. something he does that you've never seen done before.
I've never played or worked for a coach that values the relationship with his players. Like, he builds these, and you know, he went to medical school, right? And so maybe it's this like patient doctor thing that he has or just has in him, even though he dropped out after 3 years. He develops these relations with these kids, whether he's recruiting them or he's got them, like they're on his roster, better than anyone I've ever seen. Like, they're always in his office. He's watching film with them. He's on the court with them. He's talking to them on the sideline. And these kids, like, they soak everything up. He just has a way, whether you're from Salt Lake City, Utah, from a Mormon family, whether you're from the inner city of Minnesota with no family, right, and you're just broken home, whether you're a European kid, he finds, like, his whole thing is, like, I want to know how these kids tick, and I want to know what makes them talk. And he's better than anybody that I've been around. And I know there's really good coaches out there. I do. But at the end of the day, like, the relationships he builds with these players and these recruits and how he cultivates them and spends time with them and genuinely cares about their every little detail of their life is amazing. And it's rubbed off on me where with the hours and the rules we're allowed to spend with them, we're constantly doing that. We're constantly having that. We want these guys to come up to our office and talk to us. We want these guys to come in and watch film. We want these guys to get off the gun or to put the cones away and let us work you out. Let us do stuff. Let us be on the court with you, right? And that's why all his whole staff are former players. Nick Robinson, Stanford, myself, Cody Figure worked for Majerus as a head manager. Was going to be a walk-on, but decided he wanted to get into coaching, so he was a manager in Utah. Because he wants those players, he wants us coaches on the court with these players. And that's why I think he's good at a lot of things, right? But I think that one, if I'm just talking about one, that's the one I think that he's better than anybody.
Awesome stuff. Well, listen, I'm glad that your family doesn't have to move. I'm happy for
thank you.
The success thank you. At the end of the day. We've known each other for a long, long, long time.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate you spending some time. We'll hang out some this summer on the circuit. In the meantime, get back to work, because I'm sure at some point Mark Pope's going to be like, hey, why have you been on the phone for an hour and a half with a guy like
Yeah, we'll be all right. I'm recruiting, coach recruiting here. So, no, I appreciate you having me on. It's always fun. I love talking to you. I love listening to your stuff and love following you. So it was cool to come on. I appreciate it.
CB, my man, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Doug.
My thanks to Chris Burgess and my thanks to basketball. How good has basketball been recently? All right, we'll react to all the results. Wait to hear next week's guest. Thanks for downloading, subscribing, and rating. Don't forget to tune in to the Doug Gottlieb Show, weekdays 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific. You can also catch us on Sirius 217, XM 203. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball.